Welcome to the Sanity Interview by the New York Sun. My name is A.R. Hoffman, and every week my co-host Rebecca Sugar and I talk to the people you want to hear from.
One of those is Mike Duran. We're so excited to have you here today, Mike. Michael Duran is a senior fellow and director of the Middle East Center at the Hudson Institute. In the administration of President George W. Bush, he served as the senior director in the National Security Council, responsible for the Middle East and North Africa. He has taught at Princeton, NYU, and the University of Central Florida, and publishes articles frequently. His last book, Ike's Gamble, was published by Free Press in 2016. He received a BA from Stanford and a PhD from Princeton. I also want to recommend, you didn't put this in your bio, but I love your Israel update with Gadi Taub.
Thank you. Gadi always reminds me to say that, and I always forget.
Ari, yeah, take it away.
Well, it certainly feels, Mike, in the last few days that it's a kind of new era in Middle East policy, and also a kind of back to the future. I mean that the kind of kinetic war in Gaza has restarted. We're seeing a newly robust posture towards the Houthis in Yemen. I think what interested and caught the eyes of many of us was, though, not so much those isolated theaters, but the argument from President Trump via Truth Social that linking Iran explicitly to this broader effort. So kind of what are you seeing right now as things once again heat up in the Middle East?
Well, thanks. I was so thrilled by that tweet or Truth Social posting by the president about holding Iran directly responsible for the actions of the Houthis, because all during the Biden administration and even during the Obama administration before, there was this game where we would allow the Iranians to pretend that they weren't behind all of this in one way or another. And so it's so refreshing to see the president just call it like it is and actually hold the Iranians responsible. I think what's going on right now can be interpreted in two different ways, which are not necessarily contradictory. One is the president is preparing for a negotiation with the Iranians over the nuclear program. The Houthis are the last proxy of the Iranians that came out of the war with Israel totally intact. Hamas has been, capabilities have been severely weakened. So have Hezbollah's, not to the same degree, but Hezbollah's been hollowed out. The militias in Syria and Iraq were never that big of a threat anyway, but they're chastened somewhat. But the Houthis are still going strong. They have this geographic position that allows them to threaten global shipping, and that makes them really hard to for the Israelis, or for us for that matter, to severely weaken them. So the Houthis are still there, and they can potentially play a role if Israel or the United States, or Israel and the United States together, were to attack Iran's nuclear nuclear weapons program. They could carry out acts of reprisal from the Houthis. So Trump is degrading the Houthis, but then also sending a really clear message to Iran that the rules of engagement toward the Houthis, but also toward Iran itself, have changed in order to position himself well for the negotiation. That's scenario one. That we're going toward a negotiation with Iran, and Trump is positioning himself to negotiate from strength.
Let me just jump in on that. And I think a lot of folks here are like, wait a second, why are we negotiating with Iran? Wasn't that the sort of original sin of previous administrations? Israel has weakened Iran's proxies. It's weakened Iran's air defenses. Is this just about getting an even better deal? Is this what's going on there?
Well, Trump campaigned on peace through strength, and so he wants to go down in history as a peacemaker. He'd like to cut a deal between Hamas and Israel. He'd like to cut a deal between Armenia and Azerbaijan, and he'd like to cut a deal with Iran if possible. But I think he's always going to lead with the peace element. but there's the strength element as well. And he's trying to say that, you know, if you don't cut a deal that's acceptable to me, then I will not shrink from using force, either a lot of economic sanctions or, if necessary, military force. But I think he always wants to lead with the negotiation. But that leads me to scenario two, which is you could also say that that you could also interpret what's going on now as the war to destroy Iran's nuclear weapon weapons program has already begun. That this is going to be a gradual process, and step one is you degrade all of the proxies so that they can't carry out any reprisals. And as I say, these two things are not. They're not mutually exclusive. You have military operations are not just to have an impact on the enemy. They're designed to give the leadership, you know, American military operations are designed to give the American leadership options. And so they are, the American military now is positioning itself so that it, it can offer Donald Trump better options with regard to degrading Iran's nuclear weapon.
To Ari's question, the JCPOA looms large in the minds of many of us. What would be meaningfully different about Trump's deal if he were able to come to one? And do you think that he really will be able to negotiate a deal with them, or are we headed towards military action?
If we can go by Mike Waltz, the National Security Advisor's statement last weekend, he basically described something like the deal that the George W. Bush administration did with Muammar Gaddafi. You give up everything, and once we certify that, then we can then we have a deal. So no enrichment, no weaponization, and no ballistic missiles as well. So very hard to imagine that Iran would ever take that deal. So then the question becomes, is this just a tough opening position of the Americans, or are they and they're willing to take something less? And if so, what? But they have to negotiate in order to come to that. We have to see the outcome of the negotiation to see what to see what's offered. I can't predict exactly where it's going to go. I would guess if you put a gun to my head and I have to give a prediction, I would guess that that Iran will try to string this along because this is their modus operandi. They'll string this along as long as they can in order to rebuild their defenses as best they can, and hope that something else happens to distract Trump in the meantime.
We're not talking about are we talking about American military forces taking some action, or are we talking about the Israelis taking action and the Americans allowing them to take that action?
Well, we don't know. We don't know that either. The Israelis would much prefer it to be a joint U.S.-Israeli operation. They need the U.S. has capabilities that that the Israelis don't have. Some electronic warfare capabilities. Also, the 30,000 pound bombs that can penetrate Natanz and Fordo have to be carried by B-52s. The Americans have that, and the Americans just have many more capabilities. And Iran's nuclear weapons program is dispersed among many sites. So if Israel and the United States did it together, they would have the Israelis together with the Americans would have the quantity and the quality of weaponry they need to do a very complete job in a relatively short period of time. The Israelis also need the Americans for defense. You know, Iran is going to respond to any attack by sending salvos of ballistic missiles against Israel, like they did in the past. To defend against those, they need they definitely need the American THAAD system. They need the Aegis ships that they used in the past salvos to help the Israelis defend. And then finally, the Iranians are likely to try to widen the front by attacking Saudi Arabia, by attacking the UAE, maybe a terrorist campaign in Europe. They're going to be very creative about this. And the Israelis need the Americans to deter Iran from this widening of the front.
And that's just so maybe interesting about American action in, against the Houthis, is it was direct American action. Right? I wonder if that was a preview or a sort of warning that Washington is not going to be afraid to use its own bombs and its own planes.
If I were a decision maker in Tehran, that's the message I would have received.
What, can you just tell us about the Houthis for a minute? You know, we like to sort of joke that they're a bunch of ragtag Yemeni pirates, but they've done a lot of damage and they've been armed by Iran. What is their capacity? How long would it take to completely defang them? Are we close to that point?
And Saudi Arabia's role there too. I mean, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Saudi Arabia is sort of set against them.
I don't actually know, Rebecca. I started asking myself that same question in the last few weeks and intend to have a bunch of interviews with people that I think can actually answer. They're clearly extremely resilient. I mean, they've been at war for over a decade, and they were able to withstand all this aerial bombardment from the Saudis and the Emiratis at an earlier point in the Yemeni civil war. It's very hard. The terrain of Yemen means it's very hard to completely uproot them, and they have distributed their ballistic missile capabilities in a lot of areas that are also hard to get to. But I think one of the messages that the Americans are sending now is that they have completely changed the rules of engagement. Under the Biden administration, the Americans would only hit ballistic missiles that we saw being put on the launchers to shoot against us. We didn't really actually go after the stockpiles, and we didn't go after the leadership. They went after, last weekend, the Americans went after the leadership of the Houthis, and they sent the message that this is going to be the beginning of a campaign to degrade them over time. I would guess that would make the Houthis worried a bit, but they see themselves as the toughest element in the Iranian network. They don't see themselves as just a node in Iran's network. They see themselves as an independent force in international politics. And they see themselves as the serious guys. They think, when they talk among themselves, they think Hezbollah is a bunch of wussies compared to them. We shouldn't just dismiss them as a ragtag band of pirates. I think that's wrong. They are a serious movement with an identity that has to be taken seriously. But I find it hard to believe that if the United States put its mind to it, it couldn't destroy them.
Let me ask you, Mike, to shift a little bit to Gaza. What are Israel's goals at this point? How has the moment shifted in terms of both the hostage element, in terms of the military aims of striking in Gaza? So what's going on that field of battle?
So you've got 59 hostages in Gaza, 24 of whom are supposed to be alive. And the prime minister, Netanyahu, he's under a lot of domestic pressure to bring all of them home, but especially the 24 who are still alive. If you look at it from Hamas's point of view, Hamas sees this as these 24 as the only card that they have to play, really, that can prevent Hamas from being completely destroyed. So Steve Witkoff, the president's special envoy, he's trying to get a hostage for ceasefire deal. The Hamas is not really going for it because they want guarantees that they will remain in power. The Israelis aren't going to give them those guarantees. And they're afraid that if they go down this route and don't get better concessions from the Israelis, then it will be the end of them. So Israel has now escalated the war in order to put pressure on them to release the hostages. All of the you know, what happens as we go forward really depends on Hamas and how it's going to calculate its chances. And that's a very hard thing to predict.
There's a significant or maybe meaningful percentage of people in the sort of social media sphere who are not anti-Israel and not anti-Semites, but who challenge the idea that America, the U.S., should be involved in maybe not even just the Israel-Gaza-Hamas war, but more broadly, any action against Iran for fear of what it would lead to, and who ask the question that I want you to answer and articulate for everybody: what is the American national interest in degrading Iran and its proxies in the region that doesn't have to do with just defending our ally Israel? Not that that's a meaningless goal, but if you excise that, what would you answer to those people?
Oh, I think that Israel is doing our work for us. I think that the United States is in a global contest with China and members of an alignment against the a Chinese-led alignment against the American-led world order. They're pretty clear about this in all their statements. The Chinese are clear about it, and so are their allies, and that's Russia, Iran, and North Korea. And so each one of those powers is trying to weaken the American order in its immediate neighborhood: Russia in Europe, Iran in the Middle East, China in East Asia. So this contest between Israel and Iran is not really a contest between Israel and Iran. It's a contest between Iran and the United States. So the people you're talking about, Rebecca, the way they see it is that Israel is dragging the United States into a needless conflict, and they either believe one of two things or both. They believe that there's a deal to be had with Iran that we can't access because Israel is acting as a kind of a catapult, throwing us into conflict with Iran, or they believe that the Middle East just doesn't matter. So Iran can get a nuclear weapon. What do we care? We don't need the oil in the Middle East, and our real concern should be in East Asia. So if I start with the last argument first, that's like saying, we're going to play chess against our opponent, but we're not going to play in one quadrant of the board. It's very clear if you look at the relationship between China, among China, Russia, and Iran, they're all cooperating with each other. Russia is now supplying the Houthis, for example, with targeting with the targeting information. The missiles and drones, in the Russian arsenal, the drones it's using in Ukraine and missiles that it has in its arsenals are coming from Iran. So we know the North Koreans are now fighting in Ukraine. So you if we say, look, we're just going to leave this quadrant, the Middle East, alone, and they can do whatever they want in it, we're going to find ourselves in a very difficult situation very quickly, because the Middle East remains the center of the global energy market. All of the enemies of China, all the rivals of China in East Asia, that's Japan, South Korea, Australia, India, all of them are dependent on oil that either comes from the Middle East or transits through it. China is dependent on oil that either comes from the Middle East or transits through it. So if we're the dominant power in the Middle East, then we threaten the supply of oil to China, which is not an oil-rich country. If that's flipped and China becomes the dominant power in the region, then it can cut off the oil to all of its adversaries in East Asia, all of our allies. So the idea that the Middle East somehow doesn't matter to the contest with China is just silly. I don't think anyone who looks at it seriously can come to that conclusion. The idea that Iran really wants to cut a deal with us and Israel won't let us is also, I think, silly. Iran has been very consistent from 1979 until yesterday about how hostile they are to the United States. They're not stupid. They know that we have more power than they have. So they don't go at us directly. They go at us in an asymmetric way by attacking our allies. But the people who want to say that the Middle East doesn't matter and that Israel's throwing us into conflict, I think they have it exactly wrong. They want to say that Iran doesn't like us because we're so close to Israel. It's actually Iran is going after Israel because Israel is so close to us. We're the global hegemon. We're the one that the Iranians think if they weren't there, if the Americans were not in the Middle East, then we, the Iranians, could dominate the Persian Gulf and all of its oil, all of its oil resources. That's the game ultimately for the Iranians. It's not Israel. Israel, it is Israel, of course. They don't like Israel. They hate it. They'd like to destroy it. But Israel is the little Satan, and we are the great Satan.
Michael, let me ask you on that subject of interconnectedness. What do you make of the sort of inchoate peace talks between Russia and Ukraine and Washington's mediation there? And where are the interests, let's say, for Israel and for the Middle East in a deal or in no deal?
So some of the people, I think, let's call them the restraintists. The restraintists are depicting Ukraine as the problematic actor, also drawing us into a conflict that's not in our interest. And a lot of people think if that's going to happen, if Trump is going to become a mediator between Russia and Ukraine, and maybe even have a thaw with Russia, mightn't he not do the same thing with between Israel and Iran? So before I answer your question directly, let me just say, I don't think that Trump sees. I think it's very clear that Trump doesn't see the world that way. Trump is not ideological in the way that the restraintists in his coalition are. They're trying to turn him into an ideology. That isn't who the guy is. He clearly puts Israel and Iran in a different category than Ukraine and Russia. With respect to the talks that are going on there, we got to see how it all unfolds. So far, Putin is playing footsie with Trump, but he hasn't actually accepted Trump's. The deal that Trump has put on the table. I know for a fact that Khamenei called up Putin and said to Putin, "Look, I came to your aid when you were really down in Ukraine, and I delivered these drones and missiles to you. I'm in a difficult situation now. Israel has destroyed my air defenses. You have to come help me rebuild my air defenses." And Putin flatly said, "No, I won't do that." I have it on very good authority. This is a fact. This is not. This isn't me reading the tea leaves. So that's very interesting, and I see that in part as a response by Putin to the movement of Trump in his direction. He doesn't want to in Ukraine. He doesn't want to do anything to derail that for the moment. But a lot, all of this, and that's so that's a you know that's a rather beneficial aspect of the process so far in the Middle East. But I don't want to build too much on any of it. Because I don't really know where the Ukraine-Russian things negotiations are going to end up. I also don't know how if this Russian offer to mediate between Iran and the United States is going to go anywhere either. So I'm just kind of watching it to see how it unfolds.
Okay, let's jump to another part of the map, Syria. And this is where it gets good because you talk about Turkey and its potential role there, and everybody gets angry at you, or not everybody, but a lot of people. And
people that otherwise usually agree with me, they get upset.
Right. Well, that's the fun part of
the conversation. I always think that everyone should have one thing that people who agree with them usually disagree with them.
Yeah, at least one. But so this is yours. And so the Assad regime is gone. The Alawites are being killed in I don't know, meaningful numbers, I guess, on the coast. And there are lots of different minority groups across Syria. This isn't one, you know, homogenous group of people. And so the question is Jolani going to take the reins and take control of the country? What is Syria? And you have some thoughts about Turkey and its potential role in reframing what Syria is. So would you talk about that a little?
Yeah, sure. This is a huge topic, but I'll just give you a couple of points that we can discuss if you're interested. One is that a lot of Israelis and pro-Israelis changed their frame of reference the day after Assad, almost on the day that Assad fell. I haven't changed my frame of reference, my strategic frame of reference. To me, the strategic enemy in the Middle East is Iran. Everything else pales in comparison. The number one priority of American foreign policy today, and I think also of Israeli foreign policy, is to destroy Iran's nuclear weapons program. Once that threat is eliminated, and I think we have an historic window to eliminate it. Once it is eliminated, then everything else in the region gets a lot easier. The threat from Lebanon is reduced to Israel is reduced significantly. The Gaza problem becomes easier. The Houthi problem becomes easier. Everything becomes easier. So the last weekend, a regime, or weekend before last, and just before on the Thursday, former regime elements in Syria launched a rebellion against Shara. And Shara responded by calling for a jihad against them. These are former regime elements that were localized on the Syrian coast in Latakia and Tartus. He called for Alawites, the Alawite heartland there. And he called for a jihad. A lot of very nasty characters went to the coast and attacked those former regime elements, and in the process also slaughtered a large number of civilians. We don't know the number of civilians. Maybe 1,500, maybe double that, but a large number. And we saw videos of it. It was gut-wrenching. It was ugly. It was extremely disgusting. A lot of videos went out of these guys abusing and killing Alawites, and it was said that they were killing Christians and minorities. A lot of Israelis and pro-Israelis retweeted all of this and said, minorities are being slaughtered in Syria. That didn't happen. Christians weren't killed. There were some Christians killed. I've tried to get the exact number. I believe the most accurate number I've heard is 7. That's not a wholesale slaughter of Christians. It doesn't mean that we should sit back and say it doesn't matter that Alawites civilians were slaughtered. Of course it matters. It's horrible. But we have to keep our eyes on the strategic prize, which is taking down Iran and its network. And the guys who started the rebellion against Shara are the people who were historically allied with Iran. And I have to assume they're still allied with Iran. And Iran may have actually given the order to do this. And the Iranian, I follow Iranian propaganda very close. And what do you think all of the Iranian propaganda channels were saying? That's the official government channels and the unofficial channels that carry Iran's message. They were saying minorities are being slaughtered in Syria. Christians are being slaughtered. So for me to watch the pro-Israel, to American, by the way, what did Tucker Carlson say? Tucker Carlson, the primary representative in the Trump media, the in favor of who believes that Israel is throwing us into conflict with Iran, he said, minorities are being slaughtered. This is where the neocon pro-Israel effort, you know, this is, they never wanted to see that the Assad regime was actually protecting minorities. So I think all of us who believe that Israel is America's ally, that the United States and Israel are in this fight against Iran together, should take a should stop for a second and say, why are we signing on? I didn't sign on, but why are people signing on to this propaganda line that is exactly the line that Iran is trying to foment right now because it wants to take down Shara. Whatever you think about Shara Jolani, that is, whatever you think of him and whatever you think of the Turks behind him, they are not the allies of Iran. Israel was delivered the greatest strategic victory in this conflict with Iran at the hands of the Turks. Now, and the Turks didn't do it for Israel; they did it for themselves. But the toppling of Assad significantly changed the balance of power between Israel and Iran to Israel's advantage. So this quick change of the frame to say, "Oh no, we have this horrible threat from Turkey. This is the problem." This is a completely the wrong message that anyone should be sending right now, because we need to keep our eyes focused on Iran.
And so, Mike, what do you think about, I mean, obviously there have been lots of events internal to Turkey this week. There's a, you know, I would say broad-based skepticism towards the Turkish government, toward Erdogan. I mean, do you have a sort of take on Turkey, maybe a contrarian one, or is it sort of steeped in real politic, the enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of perspective? Yeah.
It's steeped in realpolitik, but not so much the enemy of my enemy is my friend, although there's an element of that here. It has been obvious to me for a decade that Turkey is a rising power, that we have to deal with it, and we have to start by dealing with it on its terms. There's simply no choice. Look at it this way. We are in an era of foreign policy restraint. The United States is pulling back from the Middle East. This is a fact. It doesn't matter whether you're George W. Bush or Barack Obama or Donald Trump or Joe Biden. You are not in favor of large-scale American military deployments in the Middle East. That is in response to American public opinion. The kind of restraintist elements like Tucker Carlson, they're hitching a ride on that wave and saying, so therefore we have to cut a deal with Iran and we should distance ourselves from Israel, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I say no. What we have to do is try to create a new order in the Middle East or stabilize the order in the Middle East by working through our allies. These are the only choices. Either we do it ourselves, we don't do it at all, in which case Iran, Russia, and China take over, or we work through our allies. And I put it to people, how many American allies have militaries that can project power beyond their borders? And the answer is exactly two, Israel and Turkey. That's it. That's all you have to work with. So when people castigate Erdogan, castigate the Turks, talk about throwing them out of NATO, we have to throw them out of NATO. How are you going to do that? Has anyone thought about that for a second? The answer is you can't do it. There's no process to do it. It's not going to happen. Have you also noticed that the Turks are absolutely crucial to the defense of Ukraine? The Turks are 100% against the Russian invasion of Ukraine, 100% against the annexation of Crimea, and so on and so forth. So we need the Turks against the Russians. The Turks are also a counterbalance to the Iranians, and they're simply not going away. They're too powerful. They're too strong. So we should start from the point of view of this thing is not going to go away. Even let's just say that Turkey is everything that its critics say it is. Everything they say it is. And let's say we can throw them out of NATO, and we do throw them out of NATO, and we cut them out of every American arms program that there is. Do you think there's no thinking here about what happens next and what happens after that? Do we think that the Turks stop being powerful and become nicer to us as a result of that? Do we think that they become a more constructive power in Syria? Is that how that's going to play out? We're in this world now where people can say anything about Erdogan, anything at all. Erdogan tortures and dismembers little children in his basement. And I say, that's not true. And then people say, why does he like Erdogan so much? Right. This is the world we're in. So this whole thing about the Alawites, I said to people, Christians are not being killed. This is not true. And they say, why does he like Erdogan so much? It's like my question for them is, where does all this criticism lead? What's the order in the Middle East that you're trying to get to? And how do you think that your proposed solutions right now are going to get us there?
Well, and I've heard you speak about turning Syria, in effect, into a buffer zone, right, between Turkey and Israel. And can you just talk about that vision for Syria and who's the we who are going to be turning it into a buffer zone and managing that?
Yeah, well, so that's another thing I always do when talking to the Israelis and the pro-Israelis, because they say, we have to do this and we have to do that. And so I say, who's the we? So we have to support the Kurds, which means the PKK that the United States is building up on Turkey's border and destroying relations with the Turks in the process. Who's going to do that? Are the Israelis going to do that? No. So it's a call for the United States to do that. And I don't think the United States is going to do that. I personally don't think it should do that. That's my own personal preference. But I also don't think Donald Trump thinks it should do that. And I think Donald Trump is going to look for a way to pull the American troops out of northeast Syria. So from my point of view, that particular call, we should support the PKK. That fails what should be the essential test of any policy, and that is likelihood of success. So a lot of the Israeli statements and pro-Israeli statements are actually not statements of Israeli policy. They're statements of what the Israelis would like to see the United States do. So signals to the United States about what they think are the priorities of the great power, the United States. And that's what we ought to be thinking about. What would we like the United States to do that would mitigate some of the threats that the Israelis see from the Turks? And you put your finger on the number one thing. The United States should be working to turn Syria into a buffer between Israel and Turkey. I think that's entirely possible. If it's a big if, the United States will actually see Syria and have a Syria policy. It historically, the United States has never had a Syria policy.
What would that look like? Would that mean Jolani would be in charge of managing that buffer zone?
I don't see any simple way to oust Jolani, and I don't think that would be wise, because who's going to take his place? Who's going to install him? How's that going to happen? What you're really just doing is reigniting the Syrian civil war if you topple him. So I think the issue is negotiating with the Turks, who are the dominant power in Syria now, negotiating with them about what Syria must look like. Syria must not allow its territory to be used by the Iranians. Syria must not threaten its neighbors, not the Turks, not the Israelis, no one else. Syria must not allow its territory to be used by anyone else who's going to threaten the neighbors.
Israel's already done some of that work, right, in terms of at least on its own immediate borders, sort of starting to conceptualize what a buffer zone would look like.
Absolutely. And that's where the Israelis should, in my opinion, that's what the Israelis should continue to focus on, their immediate border. Everyone understands. So what the Israelis fear when they look at Jolani is they fear that there's a Muslim Brotherhood onslaught coming, that Erdogan wants to launch a jihad to retake Jerusalem, and so on and so forth, and that he's going to use Syria as a launching pad for this Sunni jihad against the Israelis. What the Turks fear when they look at the Israelis is they think that the Israelis don't want a stable Syria. They want a Syria that is completely disrupted so that they can play in any part of it that they want, and one that is a problem for the Turks all of the time. It seems to me that a deft American policy could come, it could move in between the two of them and reassure both of them that that is not what's going to happen. The Turks have their interest on their border so that the PKK is not threatening them. The Israelis have their interest on their border so that nobody's threatening them. Nobody's threatening to kill the Druze who are right across the border from them. I think there's a place here for a place here for a deal, and we should go for the deal. And if there's not a deal, well, then we can reconsider what we have to do. But let's go for the deal first instead of going for a continuation of the Syrian civil war, which could lead in all kinds of bad directions for everybody.
Michael Duran, thank you so much for joining us. It was such a pleasure.